Translation: Please, therefore, leave for the north immediately, without letting your relatives know, for soon that time will approach which will diminish the good qualities of men. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. One can compensate for a life of frustration by becoming a dira, or leaving home for good without communicating with relatives. And Vidura advised his elder brother to adopt this way without delay, because very quickly the age of Kali was approaching. A conditioned soul is already degraded by material association, and still in the Kali Yuga, the good qualities of men will deteriorate to the lowest standard. He was advised to leave home before Kali Yuga approached, because the atmosphere which was created by Vidura, his valuable instructions on the facts of life, would fade away due to the influence of the age which was fast approaching. To become Narottama, or a first-class human being, depending completely on the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, is not possible for ordinary men. It is stated in the Bhagavad Gita 7:28 that a person who is completely relieved from all taints of sinful acts can alone depend on the Supreme Lord Sri Krishna, the personality of Godhead. Dhritarashtra was advised by Vidura at least to become a dira in the beginning if it were impossible for him to become a sannyasi or a Narottama. Persistently endeavoring on the line of self-realization helps a person to rise to the conditions of a Narottama from the stage of a dira. The dira stage is attained after prolonged practice of yoga system, of the yoga system. But by the grace of Vidura, one can attain the stage immediately simply by willing to adopt the means of the dira stage, which is the preparatory stage of sannyas. The sannyas stage is the preparatory stage of Paramahamsa, or the first grade devotee of the Lord. Om Agyana Timirandasya Gananjana Shalakaya Chakshun Militangena Tasmai Sri Gurave Namaha. So in the purport, there is this very powerful sentence that Srila Prabhupada states, that one can compensate for a life of frustration by becoming a dira, or leaving home for good without communicating with relatives. Although generally that is not the system in the Varnashram, Daivi Varnashram system. It's a gradual process, and you certainly make sure your wife is taken care of, your family members are taken care of, then you gradually go away. But if you have a life of frustration, then better just cut it. So in Dhritarashtra's case, this was necessary, because the attachment to family life is very deep-rooted. We just don't realize how deep-rooted it is, especially until we've lost it. I remember I was saying goodbye to my wife and young son at the time, going off to the mainland, and one businessman saw me, and I thought it was a pretty ordinary affair, you know, affectionately embracing the family members and going off. But he said to me, he said, "You are so lucky." You know, I guess, I mean, I didn't get into his personal life. He was kind of going in the next direction, but, you know, you can imagine probably had a horrible family life. So this is what the materialistic people especially want, or actually just about everybody in this material world. They want loving relationships, especially with family members. The problem is that in this material world, these relationships are illusory and they're temporary. They're based on the bodily conception of life. I had a shocking experience. I think I mentioned at least one other time in these classes. When I became a devotee, I was quite young at the time. I became quite interested in Krishna consciousness in my early teens. And by the time I was 16, I had decided within about a year, year and a half that I actually was going to run away from home and join the temple. I was in my second year of high school, and I just kind of left home unannounced and went to the temple and stayed there all during the summer. And my family wasn't pleased by that. When I was going to leave, I knew they would not approve, so I was going to have to run away from home. So when I actually made the decision, I was shocked because I started to bawl and cry. I mean, anybody knows me, I'm kind of a stoic, non-emotional person. So even back then, I was especially shy and non-emotional, and I was shocked, like, where is this coming from? Because I was thinking with my family that I was already very detached. I couldn't wait to get out. It was miserable. But when I actually made the decision in my heart, yeah, I felt this strong knot in the heart. That's what it actually felt like, and my heart was breaking because I actually decided I am leaving to join the Krishna consciousness movement. So sometimes we don't know how deep-rooted our attachments are, but it's essential that they must be broken. The Vedic system is there. They are usually broken gradually. The illusion is gradually severed. But in the case of Vidura, it had to be severed, just like a surgical knife. It had to be cut out immediately. So Vidura told him that you should leave immediately without your relatives knowing. Svayam agata gatir bhavans. Because if our loved ones know where we are, oh, that's the how I say. If we're concerned at the stage of sannyas, if our relatives know where we are, if we know if we're doing okay, then there is still a connection there. Ultimately, that has to be severed. There's psychic connection. Even if you're not physically connected, there is certainly psychic connection. Sometimes we have the experience that we maybe have not thought about a certain person for years, and then all of a sudden it pops into our mind, this person, and it just so happens that that person was thinking of us at the same time. I had one incident many, many years ago where I got in a physical fight with one devotee. I had an argument with his wife, and he came up and told me I shouldn't be talking to my wife like that. And anyway, we got a real fight, a physical fight. And I thought I was right, and he thought he was right, and we separated for years and years and years, and then out of the blue, years later, I was thinking, God, that was so foolish. I was young at the time and puffed up, and I was a karateka, and it just wasn't right. God, I should really apologize. And then I somehow or other, I got a hold of this devotee and his wife, and I apologized, and they. Especially the wife, she was absolutely shocked because she said, I talked to her on the phone. She said, I was just thinking about you and how I needed to clear the offense. So there is a psychic connection. So if we have that to our family members, then we will also be connected. So it's recommended for Dhritarashtra that he immediately be cut. But eventually, our temporary relationships all have to be cut, either immediately or within time. Illusory relationships. In India, I understand that when one takes sannyas, they actually have a funeral ceremony right then and there, because for all intents and purposes, sannyas means he is dying. Never to hear of him again. He's gone, never to come back to the village again. So that is necessary. Srila Prabhupada alludes to different stages of renunciation. One is dira, Dhira usually means self-control, just like Lord Shiva is considered to be Dhira. Srila Prabhupada says in the previous purport that one who is not disturbed by being away from family. So in other words, somebody who's self-controlled. Okay, sorry. Then it's the preparatory stage of sannyas, because nobody should take sannyas unless they can control their senses and are able to leave the family. So one has to come to that stage, and then sannyas is the external renunciation of family life. Srila Prabhupada says that one in the renounced order of life, a sannyas, is a sannyasi. A sannyasi by frustrated sentiment. Huh. So, yes, sannyas is the external symptom that one needs to take, being frustrated with the temporary relationships of this world. However, there is a higher stage, and that stage is called the Paramahamsa stage, or he's also calling it the, as in the, I think, two verses ago. Vidura said, use the same word, Narottama. Nara is man, and Uttama is the best of all men. So the best of all men has attained the Paramahamsa stage, which I believe we could fairly say is at least the stage of rati, or attachment, because instead of being attached to the family or giving up the family out of frustration, they have switched their attachment to Krishna. And that is the internal situation instead of just the external position of being a sannyasi. So, and Srila Prabhupada says that a Paramahamsa or a Narottama is a sincere devotee of the Lord who awakens God consciousness by hearing and chanting and leaves home depending completely on the personality of Godhead who resides in his heart. So I think the point here is that by the mercy of great souls, just like Vidura, anyone can attain perfection by being willing to follow their instructions. Where was the sentence? I'm not going to find it. Anyway, somewhere it says that by being willing, here it is. And this is the first sentence. Vidura advises elder brother to adopt the way without delay. No, it wasn't. Anyway, if one has simply desire to attain the stage, then he will be able to rise to that stage. How come I don't see it? Anyway, here it is, towards the end. But by the grace of Vidura, one can attain the stage immediately simply by being willing to adopt the means of Vidura's stage. So what he's advising him is that that he should leave without consideration of material convention, because these things are actually useless. They're temporary, and they will cease. And nobody is going to be able to stop it either. Even if we don't want to stop our temporary relationships, they will be broken by the force of time. This is a powerful statement that Srila Prabhupada is making, that he could compensate for a life of frustration through becoming Dhira, by becoming sannyas, and then by finally attaining a rati, attachment to Krishna, or becoming a Narottama. So there was one time I tried to find this. I couldn't find it in the database, but I can be very confident that I heard this within a year or two ago, so it's in my memory. I hope it's accurate. But there was one time Srila Prabhupada was in a conversation. I think it was actually with Allen Ginsberg, but I don't quite remember. Anyway, with somebody, he was saying that yes, my Guru Maharaj gave me this order to preach, and from our first meeting, and I should have taken it up immediately. However, even though in this old age I'm trying to do something, basically that's what he was saying. It was just heartrending. Imagine Srila Prabhupada's sentiment like that. He did so much, and he always had the desire in his heart to fulfill the orders of the spiritual master. But he was saying, at least in this old age, I'm able to do something. So imagine what he did. So in a similar way, I very much appreciated that instruction Srila Prabhupada gave, because the reaction for me was that whether one is old or not, that doesn't matter. The point is, whether if one is in devotional service and he has been avoiding surrendering, one should not allow himself to become discouraged and therefore say that it cannot be done, to think within himself it cannot be done. At any stage, it can be completed. Krishna consciousness, we can advance simply by being willing to adopt the means. We should never allow ourselves to become discouraged. Now, this morning, it just so happened, by Krishna's arrangement, I, by accident, doing something else, I opened up an email that was 2.5 years old that Mother Earth. Okay. Whoops. That Mother Ermile had sent me, and I just never opened it up. And I opened it up this morning, and I said, oh my God, this is just what I needed to hear. And I wanted to read a story that she sent me. It's rather a long story, but I just do not think that I can give justice to telling you what it's about without reading it so you can feel the full impact. So with I hope that everyone who's listening can be patient to hear this. It's a little bit long, and I'll just try and go through it. At least for me, I found it very powerful. This is by Linda Williams of Law Center, Washington, dated April 1995. It happened at the dentist's office 2 weeks before I was to be married. I had gone in to have a wisdom tooth pulled. You don't want a toothache on your honeymoon, David had urged me. All done, the dentist said, bringing the chair upright. All done, he repeated, when I didn't get up. I couldn't move. I was hurried to a hospital where doctors attributed the strange paralysis to an anesthetic used by the dentist. Very slowly, movement returned. I remained in the hospital for a month, and it was 6 months before I could return to nursing school. David still wanted to get married right away, but I insisted on waiting. What if I didn't? What if I hadn't been? What if it hadn't been the anesthetic? How could I ask David to take a sick wife? We were young. I was 20 and he was 23. We could afford to wait. I completed nursing training and got a hospital job. The paralysis did not reoccur. Recur. There were a few related things, or so I thought. Days went. My vision blurred. Sometimes at the end of my shift, my left foot would start to drag. You're just working too hard, David would say. In 1974, 3 years after our original wedding date, we were married. The following year, Jennifer was born. 2 years later, Trisha. Was a string of complications, dizziness, kidney infections, ulcers, pregnancy related, as the obstetrician assured me? Wanting to raise our family in the country, we bought a secondhand mobile home on 15 acres in Washington State. I worked the 3 to 11 shift at Beth Kaiser Hospital in Portland, Oregon, 30 miles away, leaving when David got home from his work repairing welding equipment. Making my rounds, I began to notice that my whole left side often lagged behind the right. David and I always got up at 5 a.m. to pray together before he left for work. Daily now, we asked for healing. I started losing weight so rapidly that the hospital shifted me to a part-time work and put me through a battery of tests without arriving at a diagnosis. In 1980, I was down from 130 to only 75 pounds, and doctors insisted on putting me in the hospital. 2 days after being admitted, I woke in the hospital room to discover I could not lift my head legs, arms, or hands. As in the dentist chair 10 years earlier, there was no response. By week's ends, catheters and feeding tubes were keeping me alive. Around me, the room darkened. Finally, I knew when it was daytime only by asking the nurse. Then, as the paralysis spread to my throat, I could not even do this. Finally, a specialist confirmed that I had multiple sclerosis. As a nurse, I was all too familiar with this disease, which progressively destroys nerves. I was 30 years old, and I realized that I might be dying. After 2 months in the hospital, I was to be released to a nursing home. Blind, mute, paralyzed, I would require total care. David held my unresponding hand as the doctor named several institutions. You can look at them, Mr. Williams, and let me know. I don't need to look at them. That was David's voice. Linda is coming home. And over the doctor's protest, home I went. I was sure that after 6 and 4, Jennifer and Tricia would be terrified by the forest of tubes, but I heard only excitement in their voices. Mommy's home. Mommy, what kind of mother could I be as I waited for death in that little mobile home? Attended by nurses, the insurance paid for, I lay week after week unable to move or see or speak, waiting for the end to come quickly. Worse, God, who had always been so close, now seemed millions of miles away. I knew God could heal because I watched him do it for patients I had prayed for. But when I prayed about my own health, there was no answer. You have health. Use it. I had what? Where had such a ludicrous thought come from? Certainly not from me. I was sick, helpless. Why, the only part of my body I could move at all was a single finger on my right hand. Didn't move that finger. In the dark, I moved that little finger, a mere quiver, but I moved it next day and the next. And one after that, I took my mind off all I could not do and focused it on that responsive muscle. Physically, it was a movement of centimeters, but it was my understanding, a journey of light years. Instead of bombarding heaven for healing, I was to concentrate on the health I had. Healing, for example, I could hear the wind. I'm sorry, hearing, for example, I could hear the wind in the firs, the chatter of the girls as they dressed their dolls. Thought, I could reason, I could pray, thanking God for husband, for children, for myself, or for himself. What could a single finger do? Gesture, a greeting, when I heard footsteps in the room. One day as I waved at David this way, a second finger trembled into motion. A week later, I coaxed a few choking sounds from my voice. Soon afterward, I saw one blur of brown and another of yellow beside the bed. The darker was Jenny's brunette curls, and the yellow one, blonde Tricia. As my sight improved and more muscles responded, my right hand and arm, I discovered an amazing range of activities within inches of me. Jenny and Trish developed an uncanny ability to make sense of my garbled speech. With the girls translating, I communicated an idea to David. Would he wedge the pillow behind me until I was sitting up? Would he put my sewing machine on the bed table? And now, would he tuck the foot treadle beneath my right arm? I'm sorry, it's called a treadle, you know, that thing you use with your foot. So it was that the girls and I began making spring wardrobes. They cut the fabric and guided it through the machine, but I was the one who used a bit of motion I had to start and stop the needle. Doctors cautioned that such temporary reversals are not unusual with MS. The patient could improve, but sooner or later the disease might reassert itself. I stopped focusing on the disease, however, simply enjoying each gift of health, like the time when strapped in a wheelchair, I was first wheeled out of the bedroom. Like teaching the girls to cook, they pushed me into the kitchen and together we baked bread and made soup and pies. David built a ramp beside the front steps so that I could be wheeled outside. When growing season came, I mounted a foam rubber pad on a board with wheels, narrow enough to be pulled between the rows of beans and carrots. Lying face down, I dug my fingers into the damp soil. Use the health you have, God kept telling me, and how many uses there were for each regaining ability. Much as I had improved, it was obvious I couldn't go back to nursing in a wheelchair. But there were so many things I could do. Parenting, for example, teaching, encouraging, loving. When we learned that our church supported an orphanage in Guatemala, we asked to be considered as an adopted family. And in 1984, 4-year-old Sarah became ours. Caring for a small child used every ounce of the health I had, and the more health I used, the more seemed to come. To continue the stretching, as Sarah grew older, I enrolled in foster care classes offered by the state social agency, and proudly heard our home declared ideally suited for nurturing children. But MS was advancing again. Breathing was often a struggle, even with oxygen. Time after time, I was admitted to the hospital, pronounced terminal, but survived to return home once again. To use the help I had was hard, as the pain in my abdomen became constant. A post-surgery patient is given 10 milligrams of morphine. By 1990, I was given 400 milligrams a day. When even that was not enough, surgeons in August 1992 postponed severing my spinal cord. That would mean I'd never walk again, but of course I couldn't anyway. Another opinion was partial removal of my digestive tract, as it was 11 years since I had taken food by mouth. This too would make no difference. My reason for refusing both procedures must have seemed ridiculous. The conviction that God was still saying, "You have health, use it." A few months after the surgeon's radical proposals, our first foster child was placed with us. With my mounting handicaps, I would never have attempted it alone, but our three girls were so eager that we went ahead. Already a veteran of 12 foster homes at age 3, Brandon was a silent child who never smiled. It was a joy to see him soon turning into a lively, laughing little boy who could never get enough hugs. One day I was wheeling about the kitchen getting Brandon's lunch when I heard an unfamiliar sound, the growling of my own stomach. I stopped, peanut butter jar in hand. Was it time to attempt some food in my mouth? That day I sipped a teaspoon of watermelon juice. The next day, a swallow of carrot juice. Slowly, I progressed to solid food, reveling in the forgotten sensation of taste, and strength began returning to my legs. One day, David walked in from work to find me sitting on the couch. He looked at me to the empty wheelchair where he placed me that morning. How? Who? Eating, walking, driving a car, coming off morphine, addition after addition to my inventory of health. As my healing has progressed, more problem children have been entrusted to us. Autistic, retarded, deaf. The evaluations that accompany each child are accurate, just not important. Unique, lovable, brave. There is so much more to say about these children. I have discovered, you see, that it's not what's wrong with us that counts, but what's right. That's what I told the neurologist recently when he showed me the results of my latest test. I don't understand it, he said. I see nothing but health here. I know, I told him. I've seen nothing but health too for a long time. So that was the end of that. I think that there is a lot of parallels that we can see here in our own devotional life. We should not become discouraged, even if after a long period of frustration, we have been hampered by so many things, inattentive chanting or maintaining material desires in spite. We have so many instructions. We know what's right, but still we don't follow. Offenses to the spiritual master by not following his orders or offending other devotees. You know, so many things that can discourage us in devotional service. However, we should never allow ourselves to become discouraged. Rather, we should concentrate on what we can do right and build on that. That is how we can compensate for a life of frustration immediately. So that was a little bit long. I want to quit at this time, so we still have a little bit of time for comments or questions. So I'm going to unmute free conferencing. Let me just hold on 1 second. Okay. So free conferencing is open. If anybody has any comments or questions, they're certainly welcome at this time. Anybody?
That was very, very inspirational, Prabhu. That last part that you read, and actually throughout the class, you gave a lot of examples that, we could easily relate to pertaining to the verse. So I just want to thank you very, very much for that.
Well, you're welcome.
I mean, sometimes, we get real... I know I do. I get real frustrated, and with my health problems, I have a tendency to focus on them. And but not just health, physical health. I mean, this pertains to our spiritual growth. And I know myself, and then I also hear other devotees say, "Oh, I'll never be able to, become very purified spiritually. I'll never." It's just advancement's just too hard, so this was such a nice class, because I think that there's so much instruction on how we can really move beyond that, in a very practical way. And thank you very much. Okay. Now I just have to apply it.
I was thinking in this verse in the Bhagavad Gita, sort of an adjunct to what you were saying, like a story where Krishna says he preserves what we have and carries what we lack. So in the same way, if we sort of just concentrate on what we've got and work with what we've got and know that Krishna will assist us with that which we don't have, that which we need, which we're unable to do on our own. Of course, I mean, essentially we don't really do anything on our own, but apparently what we have to do, where we need help, that Krishna will be there to carry that, which we apparently don't seem to have.
Well, I was also to say something that a few days ago I was listening to Ravindra Swarup classes, and he was mentioning something that I never heard before. He said that Prabhupada actually specifically said that we don't have right even to think that we cannot become pure devotees. We cannot think like that. So that strikes me also. I would like to go back and actually to find more what you said about it, but that was amazing. And then you think about, yes, Vyas spirit falls, you know, the Satchitananda, and how can we can think like that? Anyway.
And another thing, yes, that I'd like to know more about that. Another thing, too, is I've run into devotees, or ex-devotees, I should say. At least temporarily, their devotional advancement seems to be halted. And they've had this black and white, all or nothing kind of thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you know, I can't follow all the way, so, you know, it can't be done, and I'm just not going to be able to make it, so I'm just giving up the whole thing. You know, and what's so nice about this example that, you know, you just last read was even just taking like a little fraction, you know, centimeters of, you know, trying and focusing on that and just keep on trying to go forward, you know, is really, really important. So, yeah, that's really, yeah, very encouraging. I feel very encouraged.
There was oh, I'm sorry, go ahead.
There was a verse that came to mind from the Srimad Bhagavatam, the 11th canto, 20th chapter, text 27, 28, where Krishna is saying, having awakened faith in the narrations of my glories, being disgusted with all material activities, knowing that all sense gratification ultimately leads to misery, but still being unable to renounce all sense enjoyment, my devotee should remain happy and worship me with great faith and conviction. Even though he sometimes engages in sense gratification, my devotee knows that all sense gratification leads to miserable results, and he sincerely repents such activities. I always get inspiration from that one. That says, even though there's problems, he says, just remain happy and worship me with faith.
That's a wonderful, wonderful verse. Boy. All right, go ahead.
Am I interrupting?
Not at all.
Okay. As I was listening to you, three verses came to my mind. Are all of you familiar with the Bhutashuddhi?
I'm not.
Can I read three verses? They're so wonderful in terms of a positive meditation. The first one is, I am by nature the eternal servant of Krishna, but by misfortune, due to being inimical towards him from time immemorial, I've been identifying with his body and have been wandering in the cycle of birth and death again and again in this material existence, being burdened by the threefold miseries. Now, as a result of some unimaginable good fortune, by the mercy of my spiritual master, I know that I'm the eternal servant of Krishna, that I'm an infinitesimal spiritual being, completely apart from the gross and subtle body. Now, by the order of my spiritual master following in his footsteps, I've obtained the good fortune of being able to serve his lotus feet, as well as the lotus feet of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu and Radha Shyamasundar. That's the first one. Now, the second one is, I'm not a Brahmin, I'm not a Kshatriya, nor am I a Vaishya Sudra. Neither am I a Brahmachari, nor a Grihastha, nor a Vanaprastha, nor a Sannyasi. But I am simply the servant of the servant of the servant of the lotus feet of the eternally self-manifesting ocean of nectar of the highest bliss, the master of the gopis, Sri Krishna. And then the third one, the devotee should meditate with great enthusiasm for serving at the lotus feet of the spiritual master, on his own body completely pure and cleansed from all contamination, with the temple of Sri Hari on his forehead, tilak, on his neck, beautiful tulsi beads, on his chest, the syllables of the holy name, and sandalwood pulp, which has been offered to the Lord on his forehead, and wearing on his body light and shining new garments. What's so nice for me about these meditations is whether we're there or we're not there, you know, obviously we're not there, but we can meditate like that, and it's kind of like that what woman that was talking. She was talking about how she focused on the health she did have, focused on the mercy what we've been given, and leave it up to the Supreme Lord. He's gonna he's going to, I mean, the process works. He's going to keep working on us. You know, Prabhupada's going to keep working on us. He's going to eventually, I mean, that's why patience and determination are qualities of a devotee. So we've got to, I think another thing that Prabhupada used to say was that we should be like, you know, the honeybee that goes to the honey, not the flies to the stool. But that applies not just to others. That also applies to ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? Again, back to focusing on the positive. See, you know, if we could even find like one shred of one thing like that, when she found one little finger, just one little something. And for us, it's the mercy of the pure devotee, Prabhupada. I mean, somehow or another, all of us have been initiated, I believe. You know, we're on the path. Now it's up to us to maintain the desire, whether we're successful or not at this point in fulfilling all of our spiritual aspirations or manifesting all of the purity that we have in our hearts that we want. You know, we're just going forward.
Very nice. I just wanted to make one other point in this regard. I was really thinking about Radhanath Swami. His biography really made an impact with me, as it does with most people. I looked at a YouTube video of him. He had gone to this big bank in Europe, and they had interviewed the people after he'd spoken. It was almost 1,000 people, and they were like all devotees. But they weren't. They were just ordinary people. They just listened to him give a talk. But they were so amazing. They said they never felt such love. He was such an amazing person. I've never met anyone like that in my life. It was quite astonishing. That was the impact that a pure soul gives to people. And if you look at his life, you know, you read his biography, he went through many trials and tribulations. When I was reading this story, I was thinking this woman went through so much. So when they started adopting children, she could easily relate to the children's good side instead of their bad side. So similarly, in the same way, Krishna may put us through all kinds of trials and tribulations, and it's for a purpose, so that we can have compassion with other people who may be going through the same thing that we went through. That was just another point that I thought we could glean from this. So is there anything else? It's about 8:30 right now, Hawaii time. Anyone else has any comments or questions? All right. Thank you so much, Prabhu, for your association and your patient listening.
Yeah.
Thank you, Ramananji. Thank you, everyone. Hari Bol.
All glories to Srila Prabhupada.
Yeah. Glory to Srila Prabhupada.
Hari Bol.